Well, thank you, Gene, and thank you everyone for joining us today. I think we have a pretty good crowd. It looks like we have quite a few folks from across the country and even a few international participants. We also have a really great group of speakers who are going to speak today, and I'll introduce them in just a few minutes. But first, let me say a few words about this webinar series. So EPA's Office of Research and Development designed this series of webinars to explore some key aspects of working with contaminated sediment sites. For those of you who aren't familiar, ORD is EPA's scientific research arm, and they help inform agency decisions. And the research conducted by ORD and its partners is driven by the needs of its stakeholders like you. The objective of this seminar and this whole seminar series is to inform both you, the practitioners and stakeholders, about the latest tools and methodologies that are available, but also, as Gene mentioned, we want to solicit your concerns and understand what research needs you might have around these subject area topics. The webinars are designed to be interactive and generate the discussion so we understand what some of those topics might be. So this is going to be just like being at a technical conference. So in light of our interest in getting your feedback, the speakers and webinar team developed a series of interactive activities to get your input throughout these presentations. To get you warmed up to this online response, we posed a question that many of you have already responded to. If you're logged on, you'll see a question much like this, and you should answer it as Gene described earlier. So if you haven't, please respond to that question. Okay, so I'm reading through some of these, and it looks like there are a lot of different challenges working with contaminated sediment. As shown on the slide, we can see that working with contaminated sediments really presents some unique challenges. The source areas, the large diffuse areas of contamination that are always dynamically controlled, there's tidal influences, there's additional sedimentation and scour going on. It's very difficult to control these, and often this results in much higher remediation costs and challenges to the technical side of doing remediation. And most explicitly, there's some really unique resources that are contained in the sediment and surface water system that we have to be very cautious of as we design these investigation and remediation activities. So given these challenges, we have to find some very effective ways to address contaminated sediments all throughout the project life cycle. That is, from investigation through remediation all the way through to monitoring. Our CSMs have to be based on really good characterization data and be robust enough to build the framework to define risk and develop effective remediation strategies. And finally, we need to ensure that our remedies are assessing and addressing the site risk through appropriate and efficient monitoring methods. This series of talks has brought together and continues to bring together experts to explore the latest thinking in these areas. So your job as participants is to listen, digest, and respond to all this information that's presented and give us your feedback in real time. So today's session will focus on the effective methods for addressing risk from contaminated sites. The speakers are going to address the concepts that are applied to selecting technologies, and they'll give some examples of specific technologies at specific sites. Our first presentation is from Chris Eckley, who will discuss the challenges with remediating mercury-contaminated sediments and how some of these challenges can be addressed. Now, Dr. Eckley has been studying mercury in the environment since 2001, and as an expert, he currently supports the Superfund and environmental assessment programs in Region 10. Next, Keegan Roberts from CDM Smith will guide us through the decision-making process for selecting different sediment remediation technologies. Dr. Roberts is CDM Smith's lead sediment engineer, and he's a technical advisor at a number of different Superfund sites that involve sediment contamination. Upal Ghosh is our third speaker this afternoon, and he'll discuss how reactive caps are used for managing dissolved and NAPL contamination at sediment sites. Dr. Ghosh is a professor in the Department of Chemical, Biological, and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And he performs research in environmental engineering and science, focusing on the fate, effects, and remediation of toxic pollutants in the environment. Now, our final speaker this afternoon will be Kevin Sowers. And he'll continue the topic of reactive caps, but he's going to focus specifically on their use with PCB-contaminated sediments. Dr. Sowers is also a professor at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and he's in the Department of Marine Biotechnology. His work primarily focuses on development of novel approaches for in-situ bioremediation of PCBs in sediments. So, we encourage you to actively participate in these discussions by responding to the various poll questions and activities throughout the session and posting your own questions, as Gene described. So, without further ado, I'd like to turn the presentation over to our first speaker, Chris Eckley from EPA Region 10. Chris.
Hi, thanks. All right, the presentation is just loading here. Okay, there it is. So I'm going to be talking about remediating mercury-contaminated sediment sites and specifically focusing on some opportunities to optimize these remediation efforts. So start out with some slides about mercury pollution in general. So the vast majority of mercury released into the environment, whether it's to the air or whether it's to the water, is in an inorganic form. And there can be different species of mercury released into the environment. And those different species can have different mobilities and affect how far it can be transported. But in terms of human exposure to mercury, it's almost all through exposure to an organic form of mercury called methylmercury. And throughout the presentation, I used the shorthand MEHG, shown there in the fish, for methylmercury. And so there's this large disconnect, both in terms of the species of mercury that is released into the environment versus the type of mercury that humans and wildlife are mostly exposed to, as well as there's often a geographic disconnect because mercury, once released into the environment in an inorganic form, can be transported long distances prior to its methylation and bioaccumulation. And because of that, it's very important for us to understand how mercury is transported, how it's methylated, and how it bioaccumulates in order to connect sources where mercury is being released and areas where people are being exposed to methylmercury in fish. And that methylation process predominantly, though not exclusively, occurs in sediments. And so, therefore, understanding sediment processes are very, very important in understanding how much mercury is going to end up being methylated and accumulate in the fish. So a little bit more background on mercury methylation. Mercury is methylated as part of a microbial process, and it's largely sulfate-reducing bacteria, but also some iron-reducing bacteria and methanogens can also methylate mercury. And so the amount of sulfate that is available to these microbes is an important factor in determining the activity and how much mercury gets methylated. And where this happens, those sulfate-reducing bacteria require anoxic, oxygen-free environments. And so that's largely in the sediments. This figure here shows spots. Let's see, can I grab that arrow, that pointer there? Oh, there's the pointer, thank you. Highlights, if you have a stream or a shallow lake, the area that methylation is going to be occurring in is exclusively in the sediments there. The bacteria really like the transition between oxic and anoxic conditions. They like to be just when the redox potential becomes negative, just below the oxycline where things become anoxic. And in deeper lakes, and you can sometimes get seasonal stratification where then methylation can also happen in the water column, but it also happens in the sediment below the oxygenated water where the conditions become anoxic in the sediment, and the redox conditions are negative there. Let's see. So, in short, the processes occurring in the sediment are very important because they are the primary zones of methylmercury production. So there's a couple of factors that really control how much methylmercury is being produced. There's how much bioavailable inorganic mercury is present, and then there's that microbial component. How abundant and active are the methylating microbes? And it's those two factors together that really dictate how much methylmercury is produced. So you can have a situation where you have you can have a lot of mercury in the sediment, but if it's bound in the solid phase, then that's not going to be very bioavailable to the methylating microorganisms. So it's really this mercury that's in the dissolved phase over there on the left-hand side of this equation that is dictating how much it gets methylated, because it's largely occurring in the pore water and not in the solid phase of the sediment. Also, anything that affects those bacteria, such as do they have abundant carbon sources? Is there sulfate available for them? Those are very important factors for determining how much and how active that microbial community is. And it's those two things together that really determine how much methylmercury is produced. And there's this idea that there's sort of this Goldilocks zone of sulfate concentrations, where if you have too little sulfate, then you may not have the right amount of microbial activity occurring. And then if you have too much, then that feedback loop of generating too much sulfide can then affect the inorganic mercury speciation as well as shut down some of the microbial activity that's occurring in the sediment. So there's this kind of optimal sulfate concentration in the middle where you can get these hot spots of methylmercury production, where you can have a lot of the bioavailable inorganic mercury plus the right bacteria conditions to generate methylmercury. So moving on to the interactive content aspect of this, or the test portion of the presentation, you can fill in, check the boxes for the factors that you think are most likely associated with areas of elevated methylmercury production. And the sort of message that I'm hoping to hammer home here is that when you have a mercury-contaminated site, it's really important to think about the other environmental variables besides just the total mercury concentration, because they can be very important in determining how much methylmercury production. So the answers that I was looking for in here are, two, the elevated sediment pore water total mercury concentration. Number four, combined with negative redox potential, having those anox conditions, combined with high organic matter content in the sediment, and then combined with a moderate sulfate concentration are the major factors. And it looks like, looking at the scores here, everyone's picking up on that. Everyone did a good job listening. And so I'll move on to the next slide here. So common remediation options at sites, and this is these are often used at non-mercury contaminated sites as well. So you can reduce the loading of mercury or other metals to the sediment site. There can also be excavations and dredging that occur, or containment through capping at a site. And these are all very effective, but they're also very resource and labor intensive, require large remediation budgets. So it's good if we can look for opportunities to optimize these remediation efforts. And we can do that by looking for areas that are elevated in mercury, specifically in that bioavailable fraction of mercury, looking for zones of higher methylmercury production, as well as preferential uptake areas where the mercury is being taken up into the food web. I'll give a couple examples of this from sites that I work on. This is an example from the Puget Sound Navy Shipyard in Washington State, which is a Superfund site. And so you have this area. Let's see, can I get that arrow back? Oh, there we go. Thank you. You know, you have this area around here, which was where the mercury was initially released, and it has since then spread throughout the inlet. These are all mercury concentrations, and the dots, there's these two kind of grid cells closer to the source. There was a 500-foot grid cell and then a 1,500-foot grid cell further out from the source. And the concentrations that are in green are all fairly low concentrations, and then the ones in red and orange are where the higher concentrations are. And this graph over here, or this figure to the right, kind of highlights our conceptual model of the site. So you have distance from the source where mercury is released, and then the sediment mercury concentration on the y-axis. But back in the 1940s, you had the major release of mercury from the site. And over time, near the source, that concentration has gone down because there's been a lot of sediment disturbance at the site. It's an active shipyard, so there's a lot of disturbance of that sediment. It gets re-entrained, and because it's a tidal system, it gets redistributed throughout the inlet. And then further from the source, you had initially lower concentrations, but as that sediment gets disturbed and moves around within the inlet, you can have higher concentrations increasing over time with further distance from the source. And so ways in which we can optimize and techniques that have been used at this site to better understand these dynamics is to understand those erosion processes and the deposition zones, so we have a good sense of where the mercury is coming from, as well as where it is being deposited within the inlet. It's also very important to look at areas of methylmercury production. And so that graph there that I show on the far right-hand side, the red dots all come from that source area, that 500-foot grid cell, and the blue dots all come from the outer area, further from the initial source, from that 1,500-foot grid cell. And what this showed us is that you actually have higher methylmercury production further away from the initial source. The area right where the concentrations were the highest, because of it being very disturbed, because of the active shipyard activities, had lower methylation potential because there was less organic material there. The sediments were becoming more oxygenated because of their disturbance. And further away from the site, even though some of the concentrations were lower, you had more organic carbon, less sediment disturbance, and as a result, higher methylmercury production. Another example of this same sort of thing is at Black Butte Mine site. The main area of concern there in terms of human exposure is about 15 kilometers downstream from the site in Cottage Grove Reservoir. And here's what the reservoir looks like. And it's kind of divided up into a couple different areas. You have this permanent pool of the reservoir that's kept with water year-round. Then you have these seasonal mud flats, and then you have this wetland area. And if we look at the concentrations of total mercury, which are here in black, the highest total mercury concentrations are in that permanent pool, and they decrease and are lower in the wetland and the seasonal mudflats. However, if you look at the red lines, that's the methylmercury, it's the exact opposite trend. You see the highest methylmercury happening in those seasonal wetlands. And this is important because it tells us that if we really want to optimize the remediation of this site, we can focus on those areas of higher methylmercury production, which are not necessarily the same areas with the highest total mercury concentrations. And the factors that cause that that wetland area as well as the seasonally inundated mudflats to have higher concentrations is really based on the hydrology of the system and how the reservoir is managed. And so I'll just focus on one aspect of this. In that permanently inundated sediments, you have a buildup of sulfide in the sediment pore water. However, when you bring all that water down and you expose those sediments to the air, all that sulfide reoxidizes to sulfate, and when it's re-wetted, you have a new fresh supply of sulfate for those sulfate-reducing bacteria to methylate mercury. And understanding this dynamic is important because it highlights that remediation options at a site can include controlling variables other than the total amount of mercury at a system. It can obviously include controlling mercury loading and the total amount of mercury in the sediment, but there's also factors other than the total amount of mercury there that are important in affecting methylmercury production. Now, it's also necessary to understand where the mercury comes from in the fish or even in the sediments that we're interested in at a site. Often, the points of exposure are geographically disconnected from the source. So if we have methylmercury in fish in a water body that's 10 or 15 kilometers downstream from a source, it's not always clear how much of that methylmercury or how much of that mercury came from a particular Superfund site versus, you know, a different contaminated site or atmospheric deposition. And so you can have mercury coming from one source, you can have it coming in from atmospheric deposition, from the global pool, or from another source if you're at a site where you have multiple sources of mercury. And historically, there's not been a good way to tease these different sources apart, but recently we've been using stable isotopes of mercury. A stable isotope is the same element that has the same number of protons but has a different number of neutrons, and as a result has a different atomic mass. And fortunately, mercury has seven stable isotopes that range from 196 to 204 atomic mass units. And we can use that difference in mass to kind of fingerprint the mercury, because any time that there is a reaction, an industrial processing occurring, those lighter isotopes react faster than the heavier isotopes. And so the lighter isotopes are enriched in the industrial byproduct. And as a result, we can have a unique signature from a site that we can trace throughout the environment. And here's an example of us doing that downstream of the Black Butte mine. And so we have our, on the y-axis, we have our measure of the mercury fractionation. And you can see the central mining area where the tailings were at our mine site have a very different signature from the background soil. And so we can use that when we go downstream from the site into the reservoir, and we can then take sediment cores and see that those that isotopic fractionation shows us that not all of the mercury has the mine signature, but a very significant portion. In this case, between 40 and 70% of the mercury came from that mine source. And this is important because it can help us optimize the remediation approach by understanding the proportion of mercury that originated from a particular contaminated site. Now, we also know that the inorganic mercury speciation, not just the total amount of mercury, is important in impacting its mobility, toxicity, and available for methylation. There's several techniques that can be used to help address that. One example would be using XAF, which can be provide a direct measure of mercury speciation. The downside of this is that you need fairly high mercury concentrations in order to do those measurements, and you need a synchrotron, which is not a commercially available instrument that can be used very widely. So there's all sorts of other chemical as well as thermal extraction techniques to understand mercury speciation. Probably one of the most common ones is SSE, selective sequential extraction analysis, which is fairly widely available commercially from different labs. And here's an example of what those results look like moving downstream from a mine site. So you can use these selective extractions of doing a water extraction versus a strong acid extraction from your sediment to determine how mobile that mercury is. And here, these colors represent the more recalcitrant fractions that are occurring closer to a mine source. And as you move further downstream from the mine source, you're getting much higher proportions of the more available mercury fractions. And that's important in understanding how mercury speciation changes from its source area, where more of the mercury might be more recalcitrant, to further away where it's more available. So I got a couple more slides here. We can also optimize the remediation by focusing on pore water measurements. There's lots of different ways to measure pore water, but having that information can be important in highlighting the subfraction of mercury that's more available. There's also DGTs, diffuse gradient thin films that can be used to provide that same level of information. In terms of controlling the methylation that's happening at the site, you can do in-situ soil amendments such as biochar or activated carbon, and they can be very effective at reducing the total and methylmercury concentrations in the pore water. However, their effectiveness can be very much impacted by the type of amendment, the type of biochar or activated carbon supplied, as well as the sediment properties and the dissolved organic matter content in the pore water. And there's my final slide here. So we know that methylmercury production is a function of both the bioavailability of mercury and the microbial community and activity. But understanding which one of those factors and how, what are the relative importance of those factors really requires doing factorial incubations or mesocosm experiments where you can add different amounts of sulfate, dissolved organic carbon, mercury, change the redox conditions, inhibit different microbial populations, and then see how, after those manipulations, how much methylmercury is produced, and that can help us highlight what are the controlling variables. It's fairly labor-intensive to do these experiments, but they can provide critical information for really highlighting what is the controlling factor causing methylmercury production at the site. So to summarize, site assessments and remediation can be optimized by identifying mercury forms and species that are more mobile and available for methylation, using stable isotopes to identify the sources of contamination, and finally identifying opportunities to reduce methylmercury that may or may not require changes in the total mercury concentration. But understanding all of that and applying that requires a significant investment in research aimed at understanding the system. And a lot of these techniques have been used in the laboratory and test plot scale, and we would really need more examples of large-scale applications to encourage more broader application of these methods. And that's the end of the slideshow. If there's any time for questions, I'd be happy to take them.
All right. Well, thanks, Chris. Unfortunately, it looks like we're right up against the clock right now. So we do have some time at the end of the seminar, and we have a couple of questions that folks would like to pose to you. So let's go ahead and move on to our second speaker of the afternoon, Keegan Roberts from CDM. Keegan, are you on the line?
Yes, sir, I am, Jim. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely. Let's get started, Keegan.
All right. Well, thank you, Jim. So, you know, when I was first putting together the outline for this presentation, you know, I was trying to think of what would be most beneficial for such a wide and diverse audience. You know, we've got people that are new to the field of sediments. We've got practitioners that have been doing this for 25 plus years. And so I wanted to make sure that I could present something that would benefit the group as a whole. And so as I began thinking about some of the biggest issues and problems that come up on the sites that I work on, I was thinking, you know, is it something associated with mobility, or is it volume reduction, or maybe performance? It's what are the big driving criteria when I'm looking at remedy selection at the sites that I work on? And the more I thought about it, the same few issues kept rising to the top. So those issues were regardless of contaminant. They were regardless of the physical setting that I was in. So what I thought I would do today is just discuss some of the hurdles that I've encountered on my sites. So that way, you know, hopefully the group can take away from that some ideas of what to plan for and how to potentially deal with as they move forward. So to give you some background on, I guess, my perspective on these sites, I've worked for all aspects of the environmental industry. I started as a consultant for industry. I then became a consultant for natural resource trustees, and now currently work for EPA and state regulators. And one of the added benefits of that is I've been able to see sites from all different sides and understand that everyone has their own perspectives and everyone has their own wants and needs and limitations. And when it comes to selecting a remedy, those are all things that we need to consider. So what would the actual specific biggest hurdles that I've encountered, regardless of which I've worked on, they generally fell into four categories. One is data. Do we have enough data? Do we have the right types of data? Thinking outside of the box, it's allowing ourselves to be flexible. You know, as scientists and engineers, we're typically a pretty rigid, structured, and process-following bunch. And so it can be hard for us to think about approaching projects and problems from angles that we typically don't. Another is incorporating adaptive management. On these big sediment sites, AM is going to be something that's very big. And it's not as simplistic as what you first think, but, you know, with the proper planning, it's something that can actually help you pick the proper remedy. And then lastly, is creating a win-win-win scenario. You know, it's admittedly one of the more difficult aspects of selecting a remedy, but I'm a firm believer that if you can understand where each side is coming from, then you can find a mutually agreeable solution. And that solution is an effective remedy that works for all parties. So, you know, I can't talk about remedy selection without discussing the tools that are in the toolbox. And, you know, Chris was actually heading on one of his slides that when it comes to the tools, we've got a fairly standard set. We've got dredging and excavation. And one of the big things that I'll harp on very quickly is, you know, make sure that you give consideration to residuals control. We've got capping, and those caps can be structured in a variety of different ways. They can be sand, they can have various sorptive amendments, they can be constructed with geotextiles. We also have MNR and EMNR, monitor natural recovery and enhanced monitor natural recovery. We've got ISS, we've got the in-situ treatment and mobilization. And then we've got the group of to be determined. Those are the novel technologies that, you know, have been developed in the laboratory and are now moving out into, you know, field and pilot scales. And that's some of the stuff that Upal and Kevin are going to be talking about after I finish my talk. And so when you're looking at criteria for evaluating these tools, at least on the CERCLA, we've got the 9 criteria that we're all very familiar with. And those first 5 are pretty straightforward. You know, it's depending on which party you're working for. You may have your own perspective, but the evaluation process is pretty set. What I've come to realize is that looking at those last 4, that's where a little creative thinking and acknowledging some of the hurdles that we've run into before can be a boon to a project. If you can be flexible and you can be creative in selecting your remedy and providing the justification for it, these last 4 can be a big win for your project. So I'll start with the first hurdle. And that first hurdle is, to sound like Marcia, data, data, data. I am a huge data advocate, but it's because the data is so important. What the data allows you to do is to develop your accurate conceptual site model, but it also gives you your baseline data set that everything's going to be compared to going forward. If you don't have the right amount or the right types of data, you might select an ineffective remedy, you know, and then you're back to square one. Or even worse, you may select a remedy that is effective, but you can't prove it. And so as you begin your sites and you begin thinking about data acquisition, how you want to move forward, you really should think about those bottom 3 bullets right there. And if I can grab the pointer. Okay, I'll just work without it right now. It's those bottom 3. Oh, thank you, Gene. Those bottom 3 bullets. 1, you know, for data, understand the environmental sample variability. You know, particularly if you're looking at biotic samples, you're going to have a lot of interspecimen variability. It's based on biological differences. We are all different. And with that, so are the biotics. 1, you need to have enough data to understand the contaminant distribution, because what that helps you do is develop your CSM and select your remedy. And then lastly, like I was saying in the bullets above, is to measure effectiveness. And so the one thing that I would advocate for is as you move through your site and you're going or planning on your data collection, reach out to your statisticians, reach out to your risk assessors, reach out to your modelers. See what types and quantity of data that they need to accurately address your site. And you can build that into a good and thorough data acquisition program without going over the line. And I say over the line because as you talk to your statisticians and your modelers and engineers like myself, make sure you stress the difference between data wants versus data needs, because I am a data hog and I will take all the data I possibly can. So with that data, you know, a lot of our big, more complex contaminated sediment sites are having multi-compartment models developed for them. Those models typically address hydrodynamics and sediment transport, contaminant fate and transport, and then a food web or bioaccumulation model. And I am a big advocate for models because I think that they are a very powerful tool. Especially in the realm of Superfund, they allow us to look at the relative magnitude of differences between alternatives. But more importantly, they allow us to explore various remedial scenarios. But with the use of models, I guess with great power comes great responsibility. With using a model, you have to understand its strengths and limitations. The models are only as good as the data that goes into them. And that goes to the previous slide that I was talking about, that when it comes to data acquisition, talk to your modelers early. See what type of data that they're going to need. Another aspect that I'll bring up is, you know, if you spend all that time and money collecting your data sets, understand that models are A line of evidence, not B line of evidence. For those people that have worked with me before, they know it's something I harp on constantly. But it's something that when a decision is ultimately made, it should reflect the empirical data and the CSM that's been developed. A lot of times the models cannot be direct 100% accurate representations of what's happening within a system. So the model, as a result, has some type of assumptions or limitations that are associated with it. And so it's, as you compare the model to the site, make sure you fall back to your data, because the data will drive you to the proper remedy selection. So the second biggest hurdle I find is and maybe it's just more engineers than scientists, but I often find myself wanting to follow a very structured and oriented process. And what that will ultimately cause is a limitation into what we can do for remedy selection. Now, some different ways that I've seen to help think kind of outside of the box and help move these sites forward are these three green bulleted items. One is sequential targeting. You know, the use of early actions or interim remedies or time-critical removals, just something that targets the most significant areas of contamination first. Because what that does is, A, you know, it allows all the parties to agree on something pretty early. You know, regardless of perspective, most groups can say, okay, this is our worst stuff. We've got to deal with it. So everyone can agree on getting it out. So as you work through the rest of the process, it benefits the system, you know, and the natural resource users, because recovery is happening. You've gotten some of the worst stuff out while you do the final remedy decision. The other is to use a mixture of approaches. You know, don't be scared to utilize more than one approach, to use a mixture of capping and dredging in EM&R. One of the things that we're doing on one of our sites in the Northwest is trying to utilize natural processes to our advantage. We've got pretty significant snow runoff and high energy flow events, and so we're looking at the potential of building some hydrodynamic flow control structures to basically scour some of our contaminated material naturally and moving into a settling basin, so that way we have access to our dredges. And hey, this way we don't have to go up the mountain to chase this material. We can just meet it down at the pool and you know, save on logistical and processing cost. The other is to recognize that pilot scale projects and treatability studies can be a huge boon to your projects. Upal and Kevin are going to be talking about some of the work that they do. And there is some really great work going on in laboratories around the country right now. And so through a pilot scale project or through a treatability study, you can try to take some of these novel technologies and apply them to your site, because they may be more cost effective or just effective in general than any of the current tools that we have in the toolbox. And so I wanted to provide an example of kind of thinking outside of the box. And this is a hybridization of a site that I actually work on, where one of the responsible parties developed the approach, which I thought was great. It's a great example of thinking outside the box. But to kind of set this up for you guys, I'll describe the site as it's a shallow braided river, as you can see in this picture. So as you've got your sediments moving downstream, they're going to move into various deposits across. We also have flooding. So the deposits actually do carry out into the floodplain. It's a northern climate, so we've got our snow melt runoff, which leads to some high energy scouring events on occasion. Our primary risk drivers at the site are fish in the rivers, and then we have to worry about the floodplains. In this example, we'll say it's moles. And then, you know, you've always got your resource user. You've got your landowner. And so in this case, you know, the landowner wants to be able to eat the fish. He wants to be able to take his kids out back and, you know, catch some fish and bring them back. And so he's willing to accept some burden for it, but the one thing he doesn't want is he doesn't want a concrete ditch, you know, flowing through the back of his land. So under this scenario, how could we address it? Under some of the typical approaches, you know, we would do dredging or excavation. But, you know, accessing all those various scarred sediment deposits, you're looking at a lot of logistical and cost concerns. And so trying to think outside of the box, you know, how would we potentially deal with the terrestrial deposits? And so, you know, one of the good ways of dealing with the terrestrial would be doing a targeted removal and capping. You know, this way we're not chasing materials that are overly deep, but we are removing the risk drivers. And then on top of it, you know, we're coming back and we're providing a cap. We're providing some type of physical barrier. That way the moles can't be exposed to it as they burrow down. We can also do channel realignment to create a clean fish corridor. The great thing about channel realignment is, hey, maybe we do have a swath of clean material that we can cut through, and then that way we're not removing just, you know, millions of cubic yards of material. And then lastly, maybe we can consider benching. You know, the landowner in this case really doesn't want a concrete ditch flowing through his back. So if we do some benching to allow natural connection between the river and floodplain, we can limit erosion, but we can also get the landowner's buy-in. And under a situation like that, but by being creative and using a mixture of approaches, what it does is it allows all the parties to go home with some type of win. The regulator has achieved risk reduction. The implementing party got a cost-effective remedy, and the landowner, he has his resource back, you know. And so it's one of those things of, it's, if you think creatively, you can oftentimes come up with a remedy that meets everybody's expectations, or at least to some extent. So another big issue that I often encounter when dealing with remedy selection is adaptive management. And, you know, and this is one of the newer ones. Now, I will be the first to admit, when I first heard about adaptive management, I thought, oh man, this is so easy. It's, you go out, you say that if you find one thing, you'll change and adapt to it and move forward. But it's not that simple. It can be with proper planning, but you can't go into it blindly. And that's the mistake that I've personally made, and I've seen at some other sites. And so just as a, I guess, full disclosure, it's going to be a site, it's going to be a part of most major sediment remedies going forward. So it's just be prepared for it. I believe EPA headquarters will be releasing some guidance documents on it soon. So I'm not sure when that time will be, but I'm sure we can coordinate with Gene to get those released as they come out. Now, one of the other things is the hardest part is getting collaborative stakeholder engagement on the adaptive management steps. You know, you've got various parties, especially at Superfund, of sites that you're dealing with. You've got the federal regulators, you've got state regulators, you've got the responsible parties, you've got the community. And so when it comes to adaptive management, what I have seen is that there are five main components that have to be identified and agreed upon in order to structure that adaptive management plan, so that way you can select a remedy and do the associated monitoring with it. And so what I have here are the first five bullets that come with identifying an adaptive management plan. And so the first is identify the blank of remediation. If you can go into that first lower left box and provide your answers.
All right, Keegan, I think that they've settled in on one particular response. So they all see it might be hard to see, but it looks like, at least for question one, objectives. That's exactly what they were settling in on.
And Gene, thank you. I'm working remotely right now, so it may be a delay in some of these coming back, so I appreciate for that. And so, you know, you have to identify the objectives of your remediation. And, you know, the objectives can be, hey, it can be broad. I wanted to be able to eat the fish again. You know, that's what the community wants. So that could be an objective, and that'll help guide the rest of these. So the second question, Gene, have the group provided their responses?
So in that case, they seem to be split between two responses. About half of them think it should be the indicators of the objectives, and the other half seem to think it's the importance of the objectives.
Okay. Well, in that case, I would say that the importance falls under the first bullet. It's when you're identifying your objectives, it's identifying what's important for the site. And so once you identify those objectives, once you identify what's important, it's identifying the indicators. So, you know, in this case, if the objective is to eat fish again, your indicators can be fish tissue concentrations or maybe water column or even sediment bed concentrations via biota sediment accumulation factor. It's some type of empirical measurement that you can quantify that. So once you identified your indicators, you identify the empirical
lines of
evidence for those.
Yep, and they're all
Oh, man, you see?
Response.
It's all coming together. In those lines of evidence, those are your assessment tools. So if you're looking at water column or pore water, those are your passive samplers, or maybe it's a standard sampling event, or maybe it's even the use of a model. Okay, and so once we have our lines of evidence, we identify our triggers and thresholds.
That's exactly right.
Oh, man, Gene, thank you for working on me with this. And those triggers and thresholds, they vary by temporal scale. You know, when are you going to do your assessments? They vary by spatial scale. Where are you going to do it? But it's also the development of empirical values. So exactly what is your decision-making point for fish tissue concentrations? Is it some type of consumption value? Is it some type of ecological effect? You really need to identify that for your adaptive management plan, because once you identify your triggers and thresholds, you can identify your actions for attainment or non-attainment. So in this case, you're going to go through, you're going to measure what you're looking for, and then you're going to decide, okay, did we meet our goal? If we did, great. Maybe that's an NFA. That's no further action. If we didn't, maybe we need to monitor a little bit more, or maybe we need to revise our CSM, or maybe we need to go ahead and do a little more work. But as you put together your adaptive management plan, if you can flesh out these five bullets and get consensus amongst the involved parties, I found that it can be a lot easier to put the details of that together and help guide your remedy selection and monitoring program. And while I can, just speaking of monitoring program, I know that ORD will be having another presentation next week, I think, on long-term monitoring. So if you guys get a chance, that'd probably be a good one to catch. And lastly, one of the big hurdles that I've found is trying to create a win-win-win scenario. And it is admittedly horribly difficult, but I've found that it's better than the alternative. The alternative being that everybody just draws a line in the sand and refuses to move, and no progress is ever made on a project. So you have to have open and honest communication. You have to understand that every one of us has our different constraints or desires or needs and perspectives. And that guides the various parties' communication and decision-making. And you have to understand that. One of the ways that we have found to move forward on some of the technical issues on the sites that I work on is through the use of smaller technical working groups, or TWIGs, as we affectionately call them. And in that type of situation, what we do is, we take two or three people from each of the parties that are technical in nature, and we just have open and honest dialogue as to how we're going to address issues. We allow people to spitball. We allow people to throw suggestions, and we don't use it against them. Because ultimately, we're scientists and engineers, and we just want to find the most sound scientific approach that we can do. That third bullet, understand that everyone can win something. What I have found is that if each of the parties can come away with a small victory, they're more likely to work collaboratively. Now, all parties will never get everything that they want, but there's no reason that we can't try to create a situation where each of the parties gets something that they've been desiring, because that gets the project moving forward. And that's something that I think all of us would like to see, is that these bigger, larger, more complex contaminated sediment sites move forward and actually get some work done. And if you can create that win-win-win situation, you can pick your remedy. So one of the ways you can do that is find opportunities for cost sharing and savings. Maybe there's a chance for beneficial reuse of material. Or, hey, multitask. I am a big fan of trying to piggyback efforts on top of each other. Let's say, for example, that you have a site and there are two sites adjacent to each other. Maybe the two sites can share processing facilities or offloading facilities or something of that nature. It helps save cost, and maybe one can be constructed sooner than the other. And the lastly is cost sharing. It's easier to do when all the stakeholders are at the table. I can actually reference, and my apologies for the background noise, I can actually reference a site that I work on where a state entity was involved in a river and did not want the river to have hard armoring along the banks. As a result, they reached out to another state partner who donated natural materials to be used to construct bank protection. So in this particular situation, the responsible party got the state to pitch in materials and cost, and the state got a more natural river. And so that's a good scenario of that win-win that I keep talking about. And so finally, I'll just leave you guys with the biggest hurdles that I've encountered when it comes to remedy selection, and that is making sure that you've got the accurate data for your needs. You know, talk to the people that are going to be involved in the decision making and then the analysis early on to make sure that you get what they need up front, or as much as you can. We'll always have data gaps, but let's try to minimize them. Understand the model strengths and limitations. They are great tools, but also understand that they've got some simplifying assumptions sometimes. So when it comes to selecting a remedy or an approach, fall back to your empirical data if you have questions. Be flexible when it comes to choosing technologies. That's something I have to remind myself of constantly. For adaptive management, be open and honest and have engagement with their other stakeholders. Open and honest communication. This I try to implement, you know, at all stages of projects. It's not always successful, but I think it's something that we can all strive for. And lastly, is just becoming creative with cost. If you can find some cost savings, whether it's beneficial reuse or piggybacking efforts or finding a partner, you know, that may make, you know, one remedy better suited than others. So with that, Jim and Gene, I think I'm done rambling.
Well, thank you. That was a great set of rambling. That was really instructive in understanding about some of the opportunities we have for addressing contaminated sediments and some real practical experience. Now, there are some questions that came up regarding adaptive management and such, but I think I'd like to move on to our next speaker. We do have some time at the end of this that will come back to you, Keegan. So thank you very much for that. Right now, I'd like to move to our next speaker. Dr. Upal Ghosh, and he is going to be talking about reactive caps. Are you on the line? I'm not hearing anything yet. There you are. Okay.
Okay. Good morning, good afternoon, everyone. And thanks for hanging in there for this talk and the next one with Dr. Sowers. So I was asked to talk about reactive caps for dissolved and NAPL contaminants, and I used that title to talk about some of the work that we have done looking at in-situ treatment, which can be considered reactive cap or an in-situ management of existing sediments. A key concept within that approach is understanding contaminant bioavailability in sediments. So I'm going to speak a little bit about our understanding of pollutant bioavailability in sediments and go on to talking about strategies for engineering pollutant bioavailability. And this is the construct of in-situ amendments or active caps. And end with a few pilot scale and full scale demonstrations of the technologies that I have had the opportunity to participate in. So the problem that we and many of you in the audience deal with often is managing exposure from historic deposits of contaminated sediments. And oftentimes we are not able to break down the chemicals or degrade the chemicals. There are new technologies that you'll hear from Kevin where we actually have a way in which one of the pollutants, PCBs, can be degraded in situ. But in large part for mercury contaminated sites, for PCBs, PAHs, large range of organochlorine pesticides, we're really managing exposure. And by managing exposure, we are bringing down the risk to the receptors, the ecological receptors or the human health receptors. But these sites are large, and they pose a big problem in terms of managing that exposure. We often rely on trying to relocate sediments into a landfill where we have greater confidence in the exposure control aspect of the pollutant in the long term. The other technology that we have used is capping, and the traditional capping would entail placing a large volume of sediment over some of these sites, which works great in some sites, and maybe not so much in some sites like the one you see me trying to take a sample of on the right, and this is a wetland in Virginia that we worked on. And this is a tidal wetland with shallow waters, 2 to 3 feet of water in many of these locations. And it's a functioning wetland, and we would like to be able to control that exposure without destroying the wetland in the first place. And these kinds of situations pose a major challenge with the traditional approaches where we would either remove the sediments or try to put a cap in that changes the bathymetry in a major way. So how can we bring in innovative ideas in trying to address some of these challenges? And I mentioned bioavailability, and bioavailability of the pollutants is a big part of determining that exposure to the receptors. Do we understand bioavailability well enough to be able to engineer it and scale in some of these large sites? Our understanding of how contaminants in sediments become bioavailable to organisms or the food chain has evolved over the last, I would say, 2 to 3 decades in a really big way. In the past, we would consider total contaminant concentrations in sediments to be bioavailable. We later realized that for hydrophobic chemicals, it's the organic carbon that controls how these chemicals partition into the water phase or get into an organism. And that led to thinking about pollutants, hydrophobic pollutants in sediments and water phase in the construct of chemical activity that drives these chemicals into a food web. And within the sediment itself, when you start probing and looking how these toxic chemicals are bound up, there are different types of geochemical components that are responsible. So when you take a look at sediments under a microscope, the things that stand out, which is the dominant fraction, are the mineral fractions, the sand, the silt, the clay minerals. And then with that, you have also a lot of natural organic materials that would be decaying plant matter and animal matter that form the natural organic component of these sediments. And they have a special affinity to hydrophobic chemicals. So the organic carbon controls some of the partitioning, some of the availability of these chemicals. But there's one more level of complexity in that is all the organic matter is not the same. And when we look even closely at the geochemistry, organic geochemistry of the sediments, we find that in many of these industrially impacted sites where we have the pollutants that we, the legacy pollutants that we are trying to treat at the sediment site, either in a harbor type of setting or in an industrially impacted river sediment setting, we find that we have introduced a lot of organic particles that belong to a class of particles that we call black carbon. So these could be coal-derived or biomass-derived, like charcoal or coke, and even soot coming from incomplete combustion of fuel sources. And then, of course, we have NAPO oil phases that get into these materials. Some of these anthropogenic organic carbon materials could be the sources of the pollutants. As a good example, that is PAH is associated with the soot or the oil phase that gets into the sediments. Or it could be PCBs that came down the water column and absorbed preferentially into some of these components. When we look at how these chemicals behave in these sediment environments, we find that black carbon, when they are present naturally in these sediments, tend to have a disproportionately high affinity and has control over the adsorption potential for those sediments. So hydrophobic chemicals would have partition constants that are oftentimes 2 to 3 orders of magnitude more strong compared to the natural organic materials. So I would rather have my chemicals absorbed to the black carbon than the natural organic carbon in sediments. And that makes a huge difference, orders of magnitude difference, in the bioavailability of the pollutants. So that understanding has evolved over the last, I would say, 2 to 3 decades, and that has led to some of our work about 20 years ago, where we looked at adding black carbon into sediments as a way to engineer the geochemistry to change the bioavailability of the pollutants in the sediments. So some of the early work we did looked at taking sediments from the field and amending it with carbon and activated carbon works really great because of the nature of its design is it offers a very high surface area for absorption per unit mass. The activation process creates that high surface area. So when we have that kind of material added into the sediments and blended in, we see the effect immediately. About an order of magnitude reduction in the concentrations of hydrophobic chemicals like PCBs, DDT, TAHs, dioxins in the pore water of the sediment. And we also see a reflection of that in biouptake in the organisms. So what you see here in the picture on the top left are these beaker experiments in the lab where we have a parallel study with controlled sediments, no amendments, and treatments with activated carbon, 3, 4, 5% activated carbon by weight, and a range of studies that have been done in the past. And generally what you see would be a picture that may look something like the figure on the bottom right, which shows the accumulation of PCBs in lethochirus in these exposed to these sediments, and for 60-day exposure, and looking at these bars that represent the different homolog groups of PCBs. And the red is the control sediment with no treatment, and the blue is the treatment with 5% activated carbon added, and see in this case 82% reduction in biouptake in organisms. And these kinds of studies have been done for PCBs, for PAHs, dioxins, and DDT, and some of those references are in the bottom, Zimmerman et al's, and going from 2003 to 2011. And that led to the understanding that we can indeed change the geochemistry by bringing in new, fresh, clean, black carbon into sediments and amend it to the bioactive zone in sediments to reduce exposure. So it's all about exposure control. We can take the sediments and mass of PCBs and put it in a landfill. Those PCBs are not available for exposure. We can put a physical cap that reduces exposure. What we are showing here is that we can change geochemistry to achieve exposure control. And that adds a tool in the toolbox for those trying to figure out a way to manage exposure and risk, resulting risk from contaminants that are in the sediments that are getting exposed to the water column, to the food web, and into to potentially to humans. I'm trying to switch to, yeah. So the conceptual model here, so this has to fit into the site conceptual model. And it's important to keep that in mind as we move through any kind of a selection of a treatment process. So any kind of in situ treatment would work in a scenario where the conceptual site model is well developed to the extent that there is confidence that the primary exposure to the food chain is coming from contaminants and sediments, and ongoing sources have been controlled. If ongoing sources have not been controlled, then any kind of in situ treatment would be unsuccessful. Dredging will get dredged sediment, bottom will get recontaminated, a cap will get recontaminated, and an in-situ treatment will not show as much effectiveness if new sediments depositing on top is has the pollutants coming with it at levels that would be of concern. So source control is a big one. Once the source control has been achieved, and the site conceptual model indicates that the exposure to the organisms are coming from two main exposure pathways. One would be diffusive release of the PCBs or the pollutants in the sediments into the water column, and then contamination of the pelagic food web like the phytoplankton and the zooplankton, small fish and the big fish, or ingestion of the benthic organisms that pick up the PCBs from the pore water from the sediments directly by the pelagic organisms. And what in-situ treatment of the superficial layer of sediments, the bioactive zone of sediments, is able to achieve is to cut down those two primary exposure pathways into fish. So the PCBs are not going away through this amendment, but PCB bioavailability is being reduced in the bioactive zone of sediments, which in turn reduces these uptake pathways into the receptor that we are concerned about. And for many of these sediment sites, the primary driver is the risk associated with accumulation of PCBs in the fish. And it could be PCBs in one site, it could be DDT, it could be dioxins. It also works for PAHs, where the primary concern would be toxicity to the benthic organisms, and amendments like activated carbon into sediments can reduce the pore water concentrations, which then reduces the uptake into the benthic organisms. So that's how this kind of a treatment would fit into a site conceptual model, and then over the long term, one would expect new clean sediments to be depositing on top of the carbon-treated sediments, forming a new layer of benthic habitat that is clean, and the treated layer, as it gets buried down, keeps acting as a barrier layer between the untreated contaminant sediments deeper down and the fresh, cleaner sediments that are depositing on top of that treated layer. So that's how the conceptual site model would function over a longer period of time. So how do we engineer this in large scale? There are two different constructs in our mind in terms of how this plays out in the construct of treatment of a large site. So the first one is the one that I just talked about, where one would put these amendments into the top layer of sediments that could be a few inches of the bioactive zone in the sediments. One way to think about that is that we're using the native material, the native sediments, changing the geochemistry to create a reactive cap out of the material that already exists without bringing in tons of new material or sand to cover it. And that works great for depositional sites, for sites where the erosion potential is low. That gives us the confidence that the treated sediments with the carbon will not get washed away. But if you have a scenario where the sediments are prone to erosion, one can do it a little differently, which is the graphic on the right. And I'm calling that a blended cover, which would be some kind of an amended cap layer. It could be a habitat layer. It could be new sand that is brought in or sediment that is brought in, clean material that's brought in, blended with highly sorptive material like activated carbon. So one can achieve the protection one would typically achieve in, say, 2 feet of cap by putting in a thin layer of a blended cover on top of the contaminant sediment. So these are the two different ways one might be able to engineer this in the field. The one on the left tends to be less invasive in terms of amount of new material being placed. One on the right brings in new material that changes bathymetry and would be a little more invasive in terms of impact to the existing benthic habitat. So I have a question from the that I would like to get some feedback on, and this relates to how often we are incorporating concepts of pollutant bioavailability in sediment assessment and remediation work. So as I'm seeing the responses come in, I get quite a few people, more than 90%, always or sometimes incorporate concepts of bioavailability within the construct of sediment assessment and remediation. So that's great. So I'm going to move on to the next slide. So one of the things we have also been able to do is to communicate some of the findings from the research and take this out to practice. And so one of the first key papers, there are several papers that came out demonstrating the science as it happened in the lab. This also involved understanding mass transfer, because a key aspect of that technology relies on the mass transfer of the pollutants from the sediments into the amendment that is being blended into the sediments. And that mass transfer process can be slow, and understanding the key bottlenecks in that mass transfer was key in moving critical in moving the technology forward and giving us the confidence that we can engineer that at scale. And one of the findings was that particle size makes a big difference. Smaller particle size, carbon works great. Powdered carbon works the best. But there are challenges with incorporating powdered, fine-grained material into sediments in an aquatic environment. So I'll talk about a few technologies that we developed further to be able to make that happen. So the first key paper that I would like to point out to is a feature article that came out in Environmental Science and Technology back in 2011. I wrote that with several co-authors. And it talks about this idea of in-situ sorbent amendment bringing a new direction to contaminant sediment management. And this is a key paper which lays the conceptual idea and some of the results from multiple studies that have been presented in the peer-reviewed literature. And in the early work that we did, much of that work was done in the pilot studies by blending the carbon into the top layer of sediments, and that's the graphic you see there in that cover page of the journal. There are other ways to put that in that I'll talk about, which is less invasive. The other key document that I would like, and many of you are probably aware of this, in 2013, US EPA came out with this directive, which talks about amendments for in-situ remediation at Superfund sediment site. And this is a really good resource for many thinking about how this fits into the Superfund process of managing contaminant sediments. And the directive talks about different approaches of getting amendments in and amendments as possible pathway towards risk reduction at Superfund sediment sites. So these are two key documents that I would like the audience to be aware of. So moving on to some of the pilot studies. So there are several pilot studies that have been done over the last couple of decades, several of them in the United States and also a few in Europe with collaborators in Norway. And it's useful to take a look at some of these experiences from pilot studies. There are multiple papers that have been published or reports that have been submitted which are publicly available. And it speaks to the range of conditions, range of aquatic environments going from rivers to marine mudflats to marsh environments and Norwegian fjords, different kinds of aquatic environments that people have attempted to bring in amendments into sediments as a way to reduce that exposure of pollutants to the ecosystem. So these are valuable resources that one can learn from prior pilot studies. I will talk about a couple of examples from my own work. And the first one here is work that one of my PhD students, Phil Gidley, worked on several years ago. And this is one connection to NAPL that was there in the title of my talk. So this is a site, Eagle Harbor, from the Washington State, and the sediments were contaminated with creosote NAPL. And we looked at breakthrough of PAH components through that contaminant sediments and through a sand cap amended different ways. So one can quite nicely predict the concentrations of dissolved concentrations of PAHs. These are the three different PAHs that come off from sediments contaminated with NAPL. So that's a pretty straightforward, relatively easy thing to do. What gets often difficult is to predict how those concentrations of dissolved components will break through a cap. So the top on the top right, we have, so this is a panel of figures that show breakthrough of phenanthrene through a sand cap. So the top one is a no amendment. So the data points are actual measurements at the top of about 2 to 3 feet of sand covering the contaminated material. And the lines are the model predictions. And the data generally follow the predicted anticipation of how these PAHs, the phenanthrene in this case, would break through the cap. And in a very short period of time, in this case, with about 20 bed volumes of flow, the phenanthrene is completely breaking through the cap. If we add peat as an amendment, it slows down that transport, and the green dots show the concentrations in the source, and the blue dots show the measurements of phenanthrene coming out at the top of the cap. And these are physically simulated caps in the laboratory with sand columns. And in the bottom is activated carbon, very fine-grained activated carbon that was blended into the sand and placed on top of the contaminated sediments. And the green dots on the top show the green dots here on the top. I picked up the cursor so you can see what I'm pointing to here. So these green dots are the phenanthrene concentrations at the source zone, and the measurements are kind of at the detection limits, below the detection limit, which is the red line, at the top of the cap, even after about 140 bed volumes of flow through that cap. And recognize here that the axis here is log in log scale. So we're talking about 2 to 3 orders of magnitude lower concentrations as an effect of the amended cap. So these amended caps really works very well for dissolved constituents coming out of a NAPL contaminated sediment zone. The other example that I wanted to give was some of the work that we have done recently looking at a different approach of putting carbon into sediments. And remember, I mentioned early on that particle size makes a huge difference. So activated carbon works best in the powdered form, but it's difficult to get powdered carbon into sediments through a large column of water. So we had an opportunity through an EPA Small Business Innovative Research project to partner with Charlie Menzi, who is a biologist, and come up with a way to put carbon and blend it into sediments without mechanically mixing the material in. And this approach involves using native organisms, macroorganisms, the native biota in the sediments to do the mixing for us. So the process of bioturbation is very well understood in the sediment environments where we have a rich diversity of benthic organisms present that kind of do the work of the earthworms in the soil, that is, till the material, bring food into the burrows, and in the process of going back and forth, they till that surface layer of sediment. And this surface layer could be 2 to 4 inches in freshwater sediments, could be a little deeper in marine habitats. So this has been recognized in the past, and this activity has been seen by many biologists who study these benthic organisms. So we wanted to take advantage of that. So when we put a thin layer of carbon, as shown here, on top of sediments, and this picture is in the lab taken after these benthic organisms, in this case, the freshwater oligochaetes, do their job after just 2 days. And they tend to burrow and mix the carbon into the top layer of sediment. And when we do this in the field, after a few months, we see a nicely blended material where the carbon that was added as a thin layer on the top gets mixed in. So how do we get that thin layer on the top over the sediment surface? And this is where some material science came in, where we took the powdered carbon and blended it with sand and clay to make these pellets that you see on the bottom right. And these pellets are heavy enough that they will fall through the water column, deposit on the surface of the sediment. So this also works great for soft sediments, where some of these pellets would embed into the soft sediment in the top inch or so. And over time, the clay would soften, release the carbon pellets, which will disperse through the bioactive zone, through the bioturbation activity, and create that create the protective layer in the top layer of sediment. So this was a conceptual idea that we initially tested in the laboratory, and then we were able to take it out to the field and demonstrate it at field sites. The one project that I wanted to mention was a work that we did for the Delaware Department of Natural Resources. This is a 5-acre lake in Dover that had high PCB levels in the fish, the fish consumption advisories, and the goal was to reduce the concentrations of the fish in that 5-acre water body. So back in about 2013, they decided to put this pelleted carbon into the lake, targeting a dose of about 4% in the top bioactive zone of sediments. Telebelt was used for a majority of the lake, and then were other methods used to get to the margins under the bushes and under the trees. And the goal was to get about 4% activated carbon in the top layer of sediments. So this is pre-treatment, and post-treatment we get within that zone of 3 to 5% activated carbon in the top layer of sediments. The key metric here, so I wanted to show you this picture of a core taken after a few months, and you see that the carbon layer is in the top couple of centimeters, a couple of inches of sediments in this core here. The key metric here was PCB concentrations in the fish. So here are some of the key results from the study. So there are four different species of fish that were monitored: the white perch, bluegill, bullhead, and the herring. Now, recognize this is called a lake, but this is really part of the St. Jones River, which is a tidal river, and there are migratory fish and there are resident fish. So the perch and the herring have a wide range; they migrate up and down, and go out into the Delaware Bay as well. Whereas the bluegill and the bullhead are more resident, and there is greater confidence that they stay within the lake and they don't migrate. So after about two to three years, what we see is a huge reduction of about 70% in the resident fish, the bluegill and the bullhead, which are staying within the confines of the 5-acre lake that was treated, whereas the white perch and the herring are not quite responding to that treatment because they are responding to ambient concentrations, exposure concentrations they are seeing through the entire system of the St. John's River. So less reductions in the migratory species, big reductions in the resident fish was observed in this experiment. So I'm going to try to conclude here with a couple of slides here. The first one is impact on benthic community. That's a big question that comes up. And the study by Lily Jansen and Barbara Beckingham showed that they looked at a large number of studies that people have done with carbon in sediments and how that impacts benthic community. And there are a few cases where negative effects are observed, which are primarily related to behavior and growth, and a small fraction shows a survival impact. But when we do these studies in the field in open systems, we don't see a negative impact from the carbon in these sediments. So key messages I wanted to end with: pollutant bioavailability can be altered in situ by altering the sediment geochemistry. We understand the science well enough to be able to model and engineer the process in the field in large studies. Two basic approaches: direct carbon amendment to sediments or amending a sand cap. Particle size is a key factor. So this is something that I would like everyone to remember, that not all carbon sizes work. Large granular carbon sizes will not function within the time frame when one might expect to see the results. It works in full scale and persistent, and performance has been demonstrated in the long term. So here's a feedback slide. There is time for feedback. Do you have a site in mind that would benefit from exploring the use of an active cap or in situ treatment?
So folks, if you have a site, go ahead and answer yes, and you can place your vote right there. If you have a name of a site, you can enter that in the Q&A section.
I see about 70-something percent, which is great, and I'll be happy to answer questions if any of you have questions that I can help address in terms of thinking about feasibility of the technology that I just talked about in addressing some of your site issues.
That's great. Thank you so much.
With that, I'm going to leave with this acknowledgement slide. Multiple PhD students, postdocs, collaborators, participated in this work. Many thanks to funding agencies, NIEHS, CERTA program, EPA, and many collaborators who made this possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Upal. So I do want to move on to the next speaker, but quickly, one question that might actually help us better understand the next speaker is, when you mentioned bed volume, can you describe what you mean by bed volume?
Yes, absolutely. So this was in the capping context. So when you have a cap and you're looking at flow of water through the cap, it's an indication of time. It's kind of a weird indication of time because what it means is how many volumes of water pass through that cap. And the volume metric is the volume of the cap. So if you have a cap that is 1 cubic meter, say, then 1 bed volume will be 1 cubic meter of water passing through it. So it's the size of the bed. So it's used to be able to talk about how much water passed through instead of talking about how much time it took to break through. Because the time to break through is really a function of the velocity of the water. So instead of looking at the velocity impact on the time, we think about it as how many volumes of water passed through that system.
All right. Does that make sense? Thank you very much. I think that'll help us better understand our next speaker, who's going to come up right now, who's Kevin Sowers. And Kevin is going to continue the discussion of granular activated carbon and specifically how it can be used for PCB dechlorination and degradation. Kevin, are you there?
I am here.
Great.
And I have the pointer. So what I'll be talking about is the use of microorganisms to go a step further rather than just sequestering PCBs in the carbon, actually degrading them once they're in the carbon. And this is, we've known since the 80s, it's been over 30 years, we've known that there are PCB dechlorinating organisms that do remove the chlorines from the PCBs and then make them vulnerable to degradation. GE scientists were working on this back in the Hudson back in the 80s, and they were never able to quite identify the organisms or isolate them and learn more about them. And so what we've been doing is we've learned a lot about them since that time, and that's what I'm going to be talking about, what we've learned and how we've taken that and are now going back into the environment and actually using this as a treatment. And I can go to the next slide. So the advantages of using a bioamended activated carbon is you not only sequester PCBs in the carbon, but then you degrade the PCBs using the microorganisms. It can be rapidly deployed. It's minimally invasive. There's minimal sediment disruption with this approach. And specifically, I'm talking about adding carbon in the form of pellets, such as the setamite, which you, Paul, mentioned. There's a reduced carbon footprint in terms of the actual deployment. There's not a lot of equipment required to actually deploy the pellets, and there's no extensive waste management or habitat restoration after that. So for us, these are all good reasons to try and pursue this and see if we could get bioremediation to work with PCB. So this is how it works. It actually requires two types of organisms. You first have an anaerobic microorganism. This is the anaerobic Hailey-spiring bacterium. And these organisms tend to attack higher chlorinated PCBs with four to five chlorines or more. Generally, the process stops or slows down once the chlorines are no longer flanked by another chlorine. And that's when you get down to the di, tri, and tetrachlorinated forms of PCBs. At that point, aerobes can then attack the ring in the 2, 3, and 3, 4 positions and then further break down the PCB and eventually through a series of microorganisms then make it vulnerable to complete mineralization. So the process requires both of these organisms to work. And so we take advantage of both these organisms in what I'm going to describe next. Now the question is, we know natural attenuation works. We've known since the Hudson River days in the 80s that there are differences in the congener makeup further down the river, and that this was a biological basis for this. The question is, why is this process so slow? It's naturally occurring. And this is one of the questions I put to you. Why do you think natural attenuation is so slow in the environment?
So folks, go ahead and enter your answer here. And if you see an answer that you like, you can click on that one also.
So it looks like someone might be hitting the space bar. So I'm going to call it up one more time, and I'm just going to remind my presenters not to hit the space bar. That could be the finicky button that's causing trouble. So I'm going to go ahead and leave this question up on the screen here for just one more moment or so to let the audience share their thoughts.
All right, we're starting to see some answers. Oh, please don't hit the space bar, folks.
Yeah, sorry about that, Kevin. It's just the space bar. Sometimes you have to click the arrows on the screen, not the space bar or arrow keys on your keyboard.
Okay, well, why don't I go ahead and I'll go ahead and answer that. Answers are coming in. So,
but we do see nutrient limitation as one of the issues.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yep, lost it again.
Okay, Kevin.
All right, so moving on. I saw some of the answers there, but now... So let's take a look at what is going on. We've been able to run experiments to actually answer this question. We've done kinetic studies. This is with a postdoc of our Natalie Lombard. We actually devised a way, one of the problems with PCBs, because they're so hydrophobic, it's difficult to get a steady state concentration to do kinetics. And we devised in collaboration with Opal's lab, devised a passive dosing sampling method where we actually dose the PCBs at finite concentrations using a passive sampler. And doing that, we were able to find that the PCB dechlorination follows first order rate of kinetics. Something we mentioned bioavailability as an issue. Well, in fact, we were able to see that these organisms actively degraded PCBs down to the level of 1 nanogram per kilogram, which is the limit of our measurement. And they were still actively following this first order rate kinetics. They could break down the PCBs. So apparently the PCBs themselves weren't limiting. The organisms could attack them at extremely low concentrations found in the environment. Now, if we model this and look at the concentration of cells, what we found is that if we increase the number of cells, we actually increase the rate of dechlorination, even at very, very low levels. And typically in the environment, what you see is 10 to the 3 or less cells per mil of PCB dechlorinating bacteria. And that line is very similar to what you see in natural attenuation. So the problem in the environment appears to be the number of organisms can actually do this. That's the rate limiting step in the environment. If you increase the number of organisms, you increase the rate of dechlorination, even at very, very low concentrations. Now, another factor is actually the rate of desorption. Bioavailability was mentioned. And in fact, PCBs adsorb very strongly organic material. And Trevor Needham, who is a graduate student of Paul's lab, ran a study on desorption versus the rate of dechlorination. And what he found was that you have both fast desorbing PCBs and slow desorbing PCBs from the organic material. And when you look at the rate of desorption and compare it to the rate by different numbers of cells or concentrations of cells, you begin to reach a concentration whereby the activity of the cells is a equivalent to the rate of desorption. And so this whole technology, what it's based on, is just artificially increasing the number of cells from a very low natural concentration to a very high concentration to equal that of the desorption rate from the organic material. And that's the whole basis of this approach. So there are different components, and over the years we've developed a number of technologies within this. First, we had to isolate the organisms. We isolated a number of PCB decorating bacteria. This took a number of years because it was a challenging thing at first, but now we know how to do it. It still takes a long time. But we were able to get different types of decorating organisms and get them into pure culture or pure co-culture. Secondly, we developed the molecular techniques. We developed very specific molecular primers so that we can look at our organism within a background of naturally occurring organisms and sediment. So we can actually quantify the number of cells per gram of sediment that we put in and monitor how long they stay there and what their numbers are. We developed scale-up techniques so we can now grow these cells up to very large numbers and very high volumes. And then finally, we need to get them into the sediment. And this is where we started collaborating with DuPaul, and he had developed this product, Sedamite, this pelleted activated carbon. And we found that the carbon did not inhibit, I mean, it's counterintuitive. We thought at first activated carbon would inhibit the activity of the dechlorinator because of a bioavailability issue. But in fact, it did not inhibit the activity of the organism. And so what we found is that we can actually coat these particles of activated carbon on the pellets. If you look at individual powdered activated carbon, you see that these biofilms can be formed on the particles themselves. And then these whole pellets can then be deployed using a number of different methods. It could be deployed using a pneumatic air horn, a telebelt, even a pellet spreader from a barge or boat. And what happens is these pellets then go into the sediment, they break down, and on the individual carbon particles themselves, the PCBs are absorbed. The anaerobic and aerobic bacteria on the particle then break down the PCBs. So you have several activities occurring, adsorption, dechlorination, and oxidative degradation, all occurring in these particles within the sediment. And as Paul mentioned, you have a benthic activity, which is actively moving these particles around in the sediment. So you have natural mixing that is occurring. So I'm going to show you one pilot study we did. This was a study funded by ESPCP, Abrams Creek and Marine Corps Base Quantico in Virginia. It was an eight-acre watershed outflow. It was contaminated with what appeared to be AirChlor 1260, about 5 parts per million, and we had 400-square-meter treatment plots. We had an untreated plot, a plot where we added just the activated carbon in the form of sedimite, and then 2 plots that contained bioamended sedimite. And the loading rate for these, we put about 1 ton of sedimite and 10 to the 12 cells per plot on the treated plot. And we first did a treatability study in the lab. These were done in sediment mesocosms. That are shown over here. We had water flowing through with the same dissolved oxygen concentration found in the at the site. And the water would flow, be reoxygenated, and flow back through linearly over the surface of the sediment. Sediment depth was about 8 centimeters, the entire benthic zone. And then we did different treatments. We did treatments with just no carbon. These two are activated carbon with no bioamendment. And then we tried activated carbon with different concentrations of organisms and different species of dechlorinating organisms. And what we found, this particular one, we had a 78% reduction in the total mass of PCBs. This contained a dechlorinator called DF1 and an aerobic PCB degrader, LB400. That was the most robust. And we added those in a concentration of 10 to the 5th cells per gram. And this yielded the greatest reduction of PCBs. When we looked at the freely dissolved PCBs using passive samplers, We saw some reduction. There's no carbon. Carbon alone, we see a little bit of reduction, which we'd expect from adsorption to the carbon. And then with a different concentration of cells, we see an increase in degradation. And again, the most complete degradation and reduction of PCBs in the water phase was with this particular treatment number 6. We saw a 97% reduction in the aqueous concentration of PCBs in this particular treatment. So based on this, these are the parameters we were going to use at the site. The other thing is we saw both the chlorination of higher chlorinated PCBs and lesser chlorinated throughout the benthic zone. So even though there were aerobic and anaerobic areas within this zone, we saw the chlorination of all types of congeners. And when we looked at the upper and lower portion of the benthic zone, you could see we had an equivalent degradation no matter how deep we went in the benthic zone. And the reason we're seeing aerobic and anaerobic degradation occurring concurrently together, you can view it here with, if you can see in this picture, we have all these channels forming in here. And the aeric, the natural environment, is a very dynamic environment. So you have constant changing of redox potentials as a result of all this benthic activity. So through these channels, you're getting aerobic conditions, microaerophilic conditions, reduced conditions, and this is constantly changing. So both organisms can actually are active side by side. So when we went back to the site, and this is a video, this is the cetamide, the biomended cetamide being applied with a pneumatic air horn. What we did is we applied the biomended carbon with the air horn, and what we did is, in this case, and then put a known amount in the next one. So we know how much carbon and how many organisms. So using that approach, these are the results after only 409 days. Unfortunately, the study only allowed us 1 year to assess the results. So plot one, untreated, there was no significant change. Plot two, with activated carbon alone, no significant change. With microorganisms added, we saw a 30% reduction and a 52% reduction in the two bioamended plots. Not only that, when we looked at just the coplanar PCBs, which is the most toxic form, we saw an 80% reduction in the total mass with no significant change in the non-bioamended plots. When we looked at the aqueous concentration of PCBs, we see plot one again, untreated, no significant change. Plot two, we do see a decrease as a result of the activated carbon, which we expect. However, in the bioamended plots, we see significantly greater reduction in the PCB levels in the aqueous space, an 84% and 95% reduction in aqueous PCBs, the bioavailable portion of PCBs, after 409 days. As I said, this study ended after only 1 year assessment. We just got some samples, which will be 4 years after treatment. We're in the process of processing those now to see what's happened in the past 4 years. And I just mentioned, below the benthic zone, we don't see a change because this approach requires this benthic activity to mix the organisms in. But at this point, we have a very, a very clean, a clean cap over any remaining contaminated sediment. So just for a cost comparison, this is general cost, average cost for different types of technologies. The bioamended cetamite is more expensive than adding activated carbon alone. However, it's quite competitive with other technologies. So it's certainly within a range of costs and can complement other technologies very nicely in terms of cost. So it's not excessively expensive. Other treatment sites that we've dealt with, we've done Baltimore Harbor, which is brackish. We saw an 80% reduction in total PCBs within 180 days. At this point, this is still at the treatability study stage. There was a river up in southeast Michigan. It was a Superfund site. Again, this is a treatability study. There was a 78% reduction in mass of PCBs within 180 days, and the pore water concentrations were decreased by 93 days after treatment with bio-amended activated carbon. This site is a pond, a wastewater treatment pond, Alta Vista, which is unique because it's extremely high concentrations of PCBs. In some portions of the pond, they're up around 1,600 parts per million. We were in an area that was at 275 parts per million, and we were able to reduce that by 80% to 49 parts per million, which was the target for the town that was running the study. And we got this in about 2.7 years. Now, granted, being in the environment is a slower process because we're going through four seasons. But ultimately, after 2 to 3 years, we see significant reduction. And right now, we're still in the pilot phase, and we hope to be moving into full scale soon, depending on the latest results. We did a full-scale treatment on Green Island and Atoll in Hawaii. This was a soil treatment area. And we saw a 48% reduction after 2.8 years with the bio-amended carbon. We did an area in South Wilmington Wetland Park in Delaware just this May, and we're waiting on the results from that. And we have another site, Anne Arundel County in Maryland, next spring, along with a second phase back in Wilmington, where we'll be using this approach for treating PCBs and sediments at those sites. So in summary, the bio-amended activated carbon reduces both the total mass and the soluble fractions of PCBs. We see a significant reduction in the total equivalency of the coplanar PCBs in every case. The PCB-transforming bacteria mix into the sediments by natural bioturbation. We've seen that is very effective time and time again. Different application methods are available depending on the site, and it's well suited particularly for environmentally sensitive areas, difficult to reach areas such as under piers, water margins, and can complement areas where dredging or capping are not the best options, or we complement dredging or capping as a final polishing step. So there are a number of instances where this may be very applicable. And Beth, this is my acknowledgement slide, and I see people are addressing the question here.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of folks have concerns with costs and regulator acceptance. Can you speak just a little bit to those two issues?
Yeah, well, cost is it's actually less expensive other than monitored natural attenuation. After that, it's relatively expensive. It's a little more expensive, at least 50-60% more expensive than using the carbon alone, but it's still less expensive than other approaches like thick capping and dredging. As far as regulators, we're collecting data, and we've had Delaware DNR has been interested in the technologies. They realize that it's new, there's slight risk involved, and they've been very active in having us test it there. And we have another a number of other sites that are interested in having us try this out on a pilot scale at their site. So, I mean, we're still running pilot studies. We're doing a few full-scale studies. And I think in terms of teasing the regulators, it's the same as activated carbon. I mean, it's a similar technology. The activated carbon's still there. We're only taking it a step further by actually introducing degradation in addition to the activated carbon. So a lot of the footwork as far as regulatory acceptance has already been done for the activated carbon. We're just adding on to that.
Okay. Well, thank you. We do have a number of questions, and we have a little bit of time right now. And since you're right on the line, let me address a couple of these that have just come in. So you just described the use of activated carbon with the help of microorganisms. One of our participants was asking, can you explain the role of the carbon in treating the PCBs with the help of microorganisms?
Well, for us, the carbon is, we're using it to deploy the organisms. So we have to get the organisms down in the sediment. I mean, you could use tines and inject them, I suppose, but we wanted something that would be a little more, easier to use, particularly in deeper sediment. And so for us, it's a carrier. And the fact that the carbon strongly absorbs the PCBs, the PCBs actually come to the bacteria. So as the carbon adsorbs the PCBs, the bacteria are there as a barrier to break down the PCBs as they are adsorbed to the carbon. And having that carbon there just adds an extra layer in terms of the treatment, because any PCBs that aren't completely degraded, and the organisms, we generally see the organisms degrade better than between 80 and 90% of the PCBs. But there's always some residual PCBs that are going to dissociate slowly. So as those are dissociating slowly, you still have the activated carbon there to absorb them and keep them out of the food chain.
Okay. And then another question was about the, you talked about a number of different reductions and the fact that bioremediation was occurring. How did you verify the bioremediation? And the question came in, did you use a mass balance with a radio-labeled material?
No, we just measured the PCBs on a gas chromatograph directly. The concentrations are high enough that we can quantify them very easily.
And what are the concentration ranges for PCBs? Is there an upper limit for what PCB concentration would be appropriate for this technology?
Well, as I showed you, the site in Alta Vista, Virginia, the sewage pond, those were concentrations we were doing around 300 parts per million, which is unusual. I mean, usually we're down in the range of at most 5 parts per million. So even at those concentrations, and we had a couple of caissons there where the concentrations were closer to 1,000 parts per million, and the microorganisms had no problem degrading them at those concentrations. So they seem to tolerate very high concentrations of PCBs with no problem.
Yeah, so it seems to work across a wide range of conditions. So one of the conditions that we talked about, actually a number of folks have seen challenges with that we saw up front and in the previous seminars, is this concept that we see constantly changing conditions in some of these sediment sites, especially rivers or tidally influenced areas. So have you had any experience with that, and would this technology be appropriate?
The areas, and this would apply to just activated carbon alone too, if you had a lot of an area with a lot of prop wash or an extremely strong current, it could be disruptive. So if you were to use this, you'd probably have to stabilize it with a cap of a heavier material to stabilize it into the sediment. And I think Paul has had a lot more experience with this as far as stabilizing the carbon. He might want to speak to that.
Sure. Paul, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. Can you hear me?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, absolutely right. So the in-situ treatments work best in low energy environments. If the energy level is high, one would have to build in within that treatment system some kind of an erosion protection system. But I think the question also may have to deal with changing redox conditions, for example. And I think what we are seeing in some of the work that we are doing is that a changing redox condition is the natural environment in which some of these anaerobic PCB dechlorinating organisms have evolved. And in the work that Kevin mentioned, we are adding actually a dechlorinator and also an aerobic degrader to finish off the degradation process of the dechlorinated, less chlorinated PCB molecules. So changing environment actually works to the benefit of both sets of organisms that tend to find the right micro niches within the sediment environment to be able to carry out both dechlorination and aerobic degradation of some of the final products. So these changing environments actually work to the benefit, and that is the nature of near-surface sediments in many of these sites, more so maybe in tidal environments. I hope that answered at least part of the question.
Okay, so they can be stabilized then, correct?
Absolutely. So that's absolutely right. So one of the things to also remember is many of these TCB contaminated sediment sites. So this is focused on TCBs because these microorganisms are designed for TCB microbial dechlorination. That what we find in my little experience in some of these sites is that these legacy deposits of PCBs happen in sheltered depositional environments. If it was a really high energy environment, those PCB containing sediments would have long gone to the next depositional environment. So oftentimes for these legacy contaminants that are not being released now, released in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, are naturally in these depositional environments. So to the extent that some of these environments might be going through periodic high-energy situations, one might need to build in additional protective measures. And we are doing that for some of these sites where one would put in a gravel layer on top of the treated sediments with the carbon and the organisms present.
Okay, so that addresses one of the other questions, I think, that came up. Many of the CERCLA decision documents now try to address this concept of resiliency, the long-term effect of severe weather on disruption of remedial systems. So it sounds like, from what you're saying, this technology either is or could be made resilient in terms of its performance. Is that correct?
That is absolutely right. So one would have to build that in, which could be some form of erosion protection layer that rests on top of the treated material.
Got it. Okay, great. Well, we had a series of questions that folks came up with kind of related to the mechanisms for this activated carbon system. So these contaminants are sorbed onto the activated carbon in some situations. Under what conditions are they desorbed, or can they be desorbed? Do you ever see that?
That's a very good question. So we went back to one of the sites, one of the very early sites that we tested this on. This is Grass River, New York. The sediments had about 4 to 5% PCBs in the surface sediments, and this was treated with activated carbon. And then we had a chance to go back 10 years later to see how the sorption was working. So in terms of empirical evidence, we do have evidence from that study that 10 years later, the activated carbon continued to suppress the pore water concentrations just like it did right after application. So it doesn't come off. The other way to think about this is, so that's the longest empirical evidence that we have from field studies. The other way to think about this is the theoretical construct of how PCB is absorbed to carbon. So the activated carbon is a black carbon material that doesn't break down. It cannot be used as a carbon source by any organism. So it's a very stable form of carbon in the sediment environment. So the carbon itself is not breaking down into something else and releasing the contaminants that it absorbed. The sorption capacity, as far as we know from the evidence that we have seen, doesn't change over time, so that remains. The only way one could desorb it out is if one would take those sediments out from that contaminated environment and do some kind of a solvent extraction. Some, not all, but some of the PCBs would come off. But in an aquatic environment, the thermodynamics doesn't tell us that the PCBs would come off that carbon in any possible scenario.
Okay, so it doesn't sound like under natural conditions the contaminants would be desorbed. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay, So one of the other questions comes up that in terms of long-term effectiveness, what about the saturation of the binding sites on this activated carbon? Do you ever see, or do you think there's a possibility that the binding sites could be saturated and then effectively not be usable?
Well, that's again a very good question, because activated carbon has a more than 100-year history of use in water treatment and gas-based treatment. And the concept of capacity comes from that type of an application where we have some kind of a flow of a fluid through a carbon bed, and that at some point the carbon bed gets saturated, it's not effective anymore. But in a sediment environment, the way we dose and target the dose of carbon into sediments is to address a finite pool of PCBs. If there is a lot of PCBs that are getting pumped through that system, through that carbon-treated layer, one would have to think about the dosing correctly to be able to anticipate the mass you need to put in to be able to be effective over a 100-year period, for example. But in most situations, these strongly hydrophobic chemicals, the mobilization through the dissolve phase is actually quite small. The vast amount of mass that we have to deal with is already present in absorbed to the sediment. So when we do the dosing, it's typically for in situ treatment, it's typically targeted towards the depth of sediment that is being treated and the amount of PCBs that's in that depth of sediment. Now, if there is a potential for more PCBs getting into that treated layer, one would have to adjust the dose to be able to get it right. So we've done a lot of, and other people have done a lot of work looking at the sorption capacity of carbon. So there is a theoretical framework to figure out what would be the dose that would be needed to be able to address either a finite pool or a continuously incoming pool of PCBs or PAHs or PDT coming through that system. And typically when you do these calculations, you are still within that range of about 4 to 5% activated carbon. That is more than sufficient to give you the protectiveness that you want.
Okay. So when you apply these activated carbon systems, you're applying them in a situation where there may be a benthic community there. Have you seen any impact? Would you expect any impacts to the benthic organisms from the integration of this or application of this activated carbon? And this goes also for the activated carbon that has been treated with the microorganisms for PCBs.
Right, again, a good question. And I think I didn't do justice to maybe one of the slides in the end that I quickly went over as I was running out of time. So there are a few good papers where people have looked at the potential negative impacts. And I think it's important to recognize that anytime we add anything to sediments, we're changing its characteristics. Even if it is just adding clean sand, we are diluting the nutritional quality of the sediments that can have a negative impact on the benthic community. So people have studied this in different ways by bringing sediment back to the lab, adding different doses carbon, different particle sizes of carbon. When you do these studies in the lab, you are able to observe some effects. Typically, when the carbon dose is above about 4% or so, you start seeing some negative effects. The first negative effects you see are maybe reduced growth and so forth. Direct acute toxicity comes at a much higher dose and in very few of these types of tests that people have done. So there's a nice summary of all of that finding from various studies in that paper that I indicated in my, I think, third to last slide. We also, in many of these pilot studies, we have also done benthic community assessments after putting the carbon in. So we go back after a month or 6 months and then take samples and send it to a lab for the benthic community analysis, and then people do the statistics to look at what changes if any, that can be determined from that can be statistically determined based on what we see in the control plot versus in the treatment plot. And in none of these field studies, we have been able to see any negative impact from the treatment activity. So that gives us the confidence that some of the negative effects that people have seen in the lab closed environment studies does not really translate so much into an open environment where nutrients are being continuously replenished with new sediment and organic matter deposition. So that's the way I understand the impact in the benthic community. And in the end, it has to be put into the context of comparing with other types of technologies. So for example, a great study that was done in Norway looked at putting in amendments of activated carbon versus putting in clay as a layer and putting in sand as a layer. And they found that putting in 6 inches of sand had the most negative impact in benthic community. So anything we put in would have a potential negative impact. The question is, does the site recover over time? Is there good recruitment of benthic community that happens over time? Is there new sediments that are coming in, which is creating a nice habitat for the benthic ecosystem to recover and get back to possibly even a better state than it was before from these impacts from these toxic chemicals? With respect to Kevin's talk and some of the organisms, maybe I can just quickly point out that what Kevin finds is that the temporary increase in the abundance of the PCB dechlorinators that we are able to achieve with this amendment goes away with time. So after 1 year, the population of these introduced organisms go down because these organisms dechlorinating PCBs are not making a great living out in the sediment environment, and they come back to a native population abundance.
Okay. So, Kevin, kind of related to that, we had a question regarding breakdown of the sedimite product. Does the sedimite break down, and do you expect reapplication to be required over the long term? And kind of a follow-on to that is, are the microbes continuing to thrive in the sediments even after the granules of sedimite have degraded and broken down?
Well, the breakdown is just the pellets themselves down to the carbon powder. So the powdered particles themselves, they're going to remain intact as they are with the bacteria on them. The microbes themselves will, since they make a living off the PCBs, as the PCBs are depleted, their numbers go down. They'll remain in the sediment. They'll remain on those particles in a much, much lower concentration, but they'll remain there for a long time afterwards. But by that time, the PCB levels are also much lower as a result of degradation. So they reach a steady state level with whatever that PCB concentration is over the long term. And they remain on the particle. The carbon particle isn't going anywhere. It's just a powdered particle of carbon. It's going to remain there.
Okay. Well, thanks. We had an interesting question come up. And, we all work at a number of different types of sites. And one of the questions has to do with, in some sites, we see an upward migration of NAPL into the surface sediments from deep sediments. I know that I've seen this at manufactured gas plant sites where you think you've cleaned up the top surface or a new seep pops up or NAPL pops up or something. Is this something that you have seen, or how would you address this using these two technologies? Any thoughts?
I can try to address that. So if there is a significant flow of liquid free phase NAPL coming up from the sediments, there are additional things that can be done. I know organoclay amendments have been used to as a barrier for free phase NAPL. Activated carbon will also do that. At least in one of the sites, one of the Superfund sites, sedimite pellets with carbon, which is made out of carbon, clay, and sand, was used to target spots where NAPL migration was happening from down below. The original treatment was was, I believe, carbon mat, and there was organoclay mat, and then there was some releases that were happening from the seams, and then thermite was used to cover up some of those smaller areas. So activated carbon will also soak up the seep and prevent it from migrating all the way up into the water column. But organoclays and other materials can be used to prevent a direct migration of the NAPL itself.
Okay. Any further comments on that from Kevin?
No, because what we have, I mean, it's just adding the organisms to the clay itself, I mean, to the carbon itself. So I don't think I can really add anything to that. It's going to behave in a similar manner, even with the microorganisms on it.
Yeah, I would add to it, maybe, Kevin, the example that you had with the wastewater treatment plant pond, with very high levels of PCBs and 1,000 ppm, there was concern about free phase, oily phase PCBs in the sediments. And putting the carbon in actually reduce some of those. What it does, it does soak up some of the hydrocarbons, pre-phase hydrocarbons, which makes it easier for the organisms to function.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Because one of the things one has to do is when you have a hydrocarbon, pre-phase hydrocarbon, the toxicity from that hydrocarbon could kill off microorganisms. So having a strong sorption capacity in that kind of an environment helps the microorganisms thrive.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, we haven't actually quantified that effect, but it likely would be happening because the hydrocarbon could be toxic to the microorganisms if it was freely available.
All right. So both of you described a couple of case studies, and you had great slides and pictures of case studies, and spoke about a number of different. And you even mentioned kind of the stage that they were in. A number of them seemed to be either pilot or small stage. One of the participants has asked about kind of the size limit and what scale is this typically applied at. You know, many of the challenges we face here are harbor level or estuary level issues with PCBs. Is this a technology that could be scalable up to that large size? And what is the largest site that you've worked on?
Are you referring to the biomimetic carbon?
Yes.
Okay. So the largest, right now we're working in sites below an acre. And the limiting factor right now is the carbon itself can be produced. If we use cetamite, for example, I think Paula would probably agree with me, that can be manufactured. The limiting thing is growing, not the aerobe, because we can grow plenty of those, but the anaerobe is very slow growing and grows to low density. So that's our biggest challenge right now, and we're actually addressing that. We're working on methods for scale-up for sites beyond an acre. So we're starting, right now we can do up to an acre. And with what we're working on now, we're working towards being able to do much, much multi-acre sites. And as I say, our limiting factor right now is growth of the anaerobe, and that's the challenge we're dealing with. And I think we have a way to do that.
Okay.
I would just add that for just the carbon amendment, the largest we have done is 5 acres, but the capacity to produce is there for 100 acres. So.
Okay.
It's not limited in any way with production or shipping or availability.
Okay, so it sounds like it's a scalable technology at this time. That's great. That's good news for all of us. Well, gentlemen, let me give you two a break for just a second, and we'll come back. I've got a couple of other questions that have come up, but I want to I'd like to see if Chris is awake again and pose some questions to him regarding the mercury contamination. Chris, are you still around?
Yep, I'm still here.
Great. So we had some questions about methylmercury and kind of its chemical characteristics. Is methylmercury soluble in water? And, you know, is it found in pore water? And what form of what species is methylmercury most likely to come from? Could you just explain that a little bit more?
It's soluble. It can be found in the pore water. It can also associate with the solid phase in the matrix, too. It has a plus one charge to it, and so it is reactive, and so it'll often be bound to something else, and that thing that it can be bound to can either be a dissolved constituent or it can be part of the solid matrix. So I guess the answer is both. It partitions between pore water and the solid phase.
Okay, great. So the other question is, it's a really basic question, but how do you test for methylmercury? Is there a specific lab test that these folks would request when they go to the lab? Is it a unique thing? Is it pretty easily obtained? Is this a lab service that we could get at most of the standard labs?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of labs that do it. You would follow EPA method 1630 for the analysis. It's been around for many decades and quite widely available at different laboratories for analysis. Yeah, it's not like a standard analytical measure, but it's common enough that it shouldn't be trouble finding a lab that can analyze methylmercury.
Okay. Are there any unique holding or sampling requirements for methylmercury?
You want to preserve your sample pretty much immediately after collection, either by freezing or with addition of hydrochloric acid, because that after collection, methylation and demethylation can happen in your sediment sample or your water sample, depending on whether you collected a solid or liquid phase sample. And so you want to shut down that methylation and demethylation process immediately after collection. So you just need to be prepared for preservation shortly after collection.
Okay. And one of the questions is, which forms of mercury are more available for methylation?
It's a good question. And, I mean, we know that it's mercury that's in the dissolved phase. That's more inorganic mercury in the dissolved phase that's more available to methylation. And in terms of breaking that down further, I mean, people have definitely gotten into that question, but in terms of looking at it in a way that we can actually measure that would be available like from a commercial lab, there's no way to really parse that speciation down into a kind of a finer breakdown scale other than like getting at your pore water phase or, you know, doing a sequential extraction or some other chemical method, which kind of gives a sense of like relative how much of the inorganic mercury present is more bioavailable, but it doesn't necessarily tell you the exact speciation of that bioavailable mercury form. So analytically, that's very difficult to tease out at this point.
Okay. But one of the methods you talked about was isotopic fingerprinting, and one of our participants was asking about that. For the isotopic fingerprinting, which media were considered? And they note that potentially there could be differences in the relative importance of the different sources between, for example, sediment and fish.
Yeah, it's a good question. And in that study, I just showed a subsample of the data that we ended up collecting. We measured the isotopic signature in soils and tailings directly at the contaminated site to kind of characterize the source signature, but then we also measured mercury in the dissolved as well as the suspended particulate form in the streams flowing in the area right around the mine site, because there can be some phase changes and change in the fractionation between looking at a soil sample from a terrestrial environment and then trying to compare that number to a sediment sample. And it's even more complicated if you wanted to compare that to the actual fractionation in fish, because every time you have a phase change of mercury, particularly if you're going from inorganic mercury to methylated mercury, which is the form that would be found in the fish, there's going to be some fractionation happening to that signature, so that original source signature is going to be altered, which makes direct comparisons between, say, fish isotopic signature and a soil sample from a contaminated site not directly possible. I mean, you can do it in a more qualitative sense to say, oh, the signatures are similar, but if you wanted to do like a mixing model and actually assign percentages to that, there's too much fractionation change between the source and the eventual accumulator of mercury. And so what we did at that Blackbeard mine site, and when I think I put up on the slide that 40 to 70% of the mercury in the sediment there was associated with the mine signature, that was actually calculated from suspended particulate matter coming off of the mine site, because that would be more representative of the signature that's directly comparable to the sediments that settled to the lake bottom. So there's a lot of kind of nuances to those measurements that I didn't go into in detail in the talk, but are definitely important to consider before applying those to your site.
Okay. All right, well, thank you. I did want to let the audience know that there are a number of different questions regarding adaptive management, and unfortunately, Keegan Roberts had to leave, so he's not available to answer those questions. But I do encourage you to stay tuned, because EPA is planning some webinars and other materials related specifically to adaptive management, which is a big issue, and it's really at the top of the list for things we want to better understand. So stay tuned, and we'll put your questions aside and send them over to that team, and perhaps they can answer them. So in kind of the last question that I have, I'd like all three of you to address this. Early in the sessions, we asked, you know, what are your challenges? And every time we came up with this issue, folks are very concerned about soft sediments and dealing with soft sediments. They seem to be very difficult and challenging to work with. So could each of you address briefly the considerations for dealing with soft sediments in either mercury or the reactive caps, or in the PCB GAC approach? Soft sediments. You want to start with Chris, maybe? Do you see soft sediments in mercury sites, and how do you deal with them?
I'm not quite sure how to answer the question. Specifically, can you clarify, you're talking about soft sediments?
Yeah, so there are sediments that are geotechnically very mushy, if you will. Think about, you know, the muck at the bottom of an anoxic lake sometimes. And that's a real challenge to deal with.
Yeah, kind of. Well, in terms, I don't have any experience with remediating those soft sediment sites, but just trying to collect good samples and characterize them, it definitely is much more complicated. You know, if you're setting down your sediment cores, there's potential just to, you know, punch right through those sediments. And often what we're interested in is that interface between the water and the sediment. And, you know, if you're sending down, a probe to collect those, it's very difficult to actually make sure that you're sampling that surface sediment layer. Apart from just the logistics of the difficulty in assessing those sites, I don't have any direct experience in different remediation techniques that work better for a soft versus a harder sediment, unfortunately.
Okay, well, that's understandable. So again, very briefly, folks, we're almost at the end of our time here. Upal and Kevin, could you briefly address soft sediments and your technologies?
Well, from my, Kevin, from my perspective, if we apply microorganisms to carbon and they become embedded in the sediments, if I understand this correctly, they're going to break down, they're going to mix with those sediments, and I mean, the organisms are going to become inoculated into the sediments. It's not terribly, as I see it, in terms of disruption either. You're just putting a thin layer of these carbon pellets into the sediments, and then they just get mixed in with the benthic activity. So I'm not sure that soft sediments, there's anything adverse about that, because the carbon just becomes embedded in the sediments. So Paul may be able to comment on that further.
Sure, Paul?
Yeah, I had my mute on, I just realized that. Soft sediments actually work great for in situ amendments where lighter density material like activated carbon is being placed. So it's actually nicely suited for two reasons. One is in many of these sites we have experienced that we get the soft, fluffy, organic rich sediment layer. It tells me one thing, which is that it's a depositional area with not a lot of energy, because if there was a lot of energy, all of that soft sediment would have gone. So that's a good thing in terms of stability of any in-situ amendment. I'll likely not need a sand cap there on top of my my treatment. And the carbon being relatively less dense material, it integrates very well with those soft sediments without impinging right through. So in our experience, soft sediments have worked great for in-situ amendments with carbon.
Okay. Thank you very much, Upal. So that is the end of the technical side. I'd like to turn it back over to our moderator, Gene. But first, thank you very much, gentlemen. Fabulous information that was presented, and thank you to the participants for your great questions and your responses. I think we all learned a lot from this one. Gene?
Thank you so very much. So I'm quickly going to walk through just a few final reminders, and then we'll go ahead and officially close out today's session. Remember, today was the third in a multi-part series that we're hosting on the Cleanup Information Network. So I'm hoping that everyone can join us on the fourth and final event in the series, which will take place on Wednesday, November 20th from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern, where our topic will be long-term monitoring. We already have recorded versions from sessions 1 and 2 in the series available to playback on demand on the CLUIN website. So you can find it at cluin.org/live/archive. And again, once today's recorded session is available, we'll go ahead and email each of you with a link so you can play that one back as well. Remember, this is all part of an information tech transfer initiative that we do through the Cleanup Information Network, so I encourage you to visit us at cluin.org. Specifically, take a look at our sediments issue area at cluin.org/sediments. And if you'd like to learn about future webinars like this series or the upcoming ones on adaptive management, I encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. Now, I will remind everybody, copies of the presentation materials are already available on the seminar resources page. You'll find that on the middle right of your screen under related URLs. You can simply click the link that says seminar resources and press the browse to button to open it. I've also included a shortcut to that link in the Q&A window for quick access. You'll find contact information for our presenters and organizers on that homepage as well. And I will ask each of you to fill out the online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's session, both in how we delivered it and the content that was covered. Now, our instructors and organizers have also asked some additional questions in that feedback form, specifically giving you an opportunity to share areas where you think additional research needs to be focused. So please be sure to take a moment to fill out that form and share your thoughts. One of the most common questions I get as an organizer or host for these events is if we offer certificates of participation, and we do. However, you'll only get one of those certificates after you submit feedback for the event. Please be sure to check the box at the bottom of the seminar feedback form to certify you are here for the whole event. That box is all the way at the very bottom of the form. And then as soon as you submit your form, you'll immediately have access to a certificate, something like the one on the screen, that you can then either print out or save for your own records. Now, if you happen to join together in a large group in a conference room, each person can fill out that feedback form on their own, whether you registered or just participated with the group. So I would ask the person who did register, please share the link to the feedback form with anyone else who joined you in that room so that they can fill out that form and get their own certificate. And for those of you who happen to be lucky enough to replay the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow the link to the seminar feedback form. Again, you'll see that on the middle right of your screen. And you can still share feedback based off of your replay of the recorded version to get a certificate. For those of you looking for CLPs, almost all of the information you would need to enter it into the system for credit is available on the seminar homepage, including the event title, description, date, time, and the number of hours for the event. We'd also recommend that in addition to your seminar participation certificate, you may want to download a copy of the presentation materials or print out your confirmation email when you signed up and throw that in as part of your documentation when asking for credit. And with that, I will officially thank everybody for joining us for today's live broadcast. We had about 310 people from all over the world, 7 different countries today. So we really do appreciate your time joining us, as well as all of the presenters and organizers who took time out of their schedules to share their expertise with you all today. So with that, we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.